Air Traffic Controller, Ursula Rodenburg. That's URSULA at Pacifica.org. That's URSULA at Pacifica.org. I'm Mike DL, founder of the Young Broadcasters of America and program director of WSKR 97.7 FM, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Thank you for listening. See you next week.
Yeah. You wish not a boy. You wish not a boy. Greetings from Rock and Roll Heaven. I'm your host, Dennis Blackwood. Each year at this time, Rock and Roll Heaven celebrates the careers of a select group of artists who have been chosen for the biggest gig of them all, a spot in the house band of Rock and Roll Heaven. In this edition, we feature a baker's dozen of rock's unsung heroes who departed planet Earth between Thanksgiving 2005 and Thanksgiving 2006. Here in Rock and Roll Heaven, we review nearly 1,000 music industry biographies to create our annual induction list. We look to honor individuals who made significant contributions to the history of rock and roll, but never fully received the recognition they deserved, or who are in jeopardy of being forgotten by the passing of time. Whether it's country, rock and roll, blues, or traditional folk, Rock and Roll Heaven honors the building blocks of a shared foundation of an overlapping musical tradition. Like all lists, induction into Rock and Roll Heaven is subjective, and for those who didn't make it, no eternal slight was intended. Rock and Roll Heaven is a co-production of Windhome Press in Silver Spring, Maryland, and Community Radio, WERU-FM, in East Orland, Maine. He hopped his first cross-country freight train at the age of 16 and was a rambunctious presence in Texas music for nearly 40 years. A native of Lubbock and a longtime Austinite, Jesse Taylor was the original guitar player for the Joe Ely Band. From 1974 to 1982, it was Jesse's job to splash rock and roll colors all over the band's cool country canvas, creating a compelling hybrid of country, honky-tonk, and bare-knuckles rock and roll. In addition to his work with Ely, Taylor also played with a long list of other noted musicians, including Butch Hancock, Kinky Friedman, and Angela Straley. Here's Jesse Guitar Taylor with the Joe Ely Band from 1981.
Please understand me, everything's all right. I just met, I got a lot of sleep last night. Everything's all right, I just know that I got a lot of sleep last night. Writing you a letter, hitting late in the night. Sitting in a cafe, honey, eating the pie. Telling you about where all I've been. Hot dog, I'm gone again. Please understand me, everything's all right. I just know that I got a lot of sleep last night. People in this big old town, that's the early to rise and the late to go down. I guess I better find a better way to stop the clock. Hot dog, a lot, get
viewer noted, Taylor plays guitar as if running down a blind alley until he crashes into a wall. Then he gets up and runs in another direction. In later years, Jesse became a noted visual artist, working with colored pencils in a folk art style. Jesse Taylor passed away earlier this year at the age of 56. Our next inductee played keyboards for one of the most important rock and roll acts of the 1950s. For 14 years, Johnny Grand plinked the ivories for Bill Haley's Comets.
See you later, alligator.
Well, I saw my baby walking with another man today. Well, I saw my baby walking with another man today. Now, when I asked her what's the matter, this is what I heard her say. See you later, alligator. She told me, nearly made me lose my head. But when I thought of what she told me, nearly made me lose my head. Yeah, the next time that I saw her, reminded her of what she said. See you later, alligator. Well, after a while, crocodile.
Johnny Grand on an alternate take of the Comets' 1956 classic. Born and raised in South Philly, Mr. Grand first teamed up with Bill Haley in 1949. Grand usually recorded on the piano, but often performed live on the accordion so that he could participate in the Comets' acrobatic performances. Although the band charted 13 songs in the American Top 40, their best known by far was Rock Around the Clock, arguably the first rock and roll song to reach number one on the U.S. charts back in May 1955. We regret to report that in its early years, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame only inducted the frontman, Buddy Holly, but no Crickets, Dion, but no Belmonts, and Bill Haley, but no Johnny Grand. We hope the Hall will correct this in the future, but in the meantime, we are proud to welcome 76-year-old Johnny Grand to Rock and Roll Heaven. He was a much-in-demand studio drummer, recording with George Harrison and Bob Dylan, to name just two. But Bruce Gary will always be best remembered as the driving beat behind the Knack. Rock history runs the risk of overlooking the impact the Knack had on radio, fashion, and the overthrow of disco. For at least a short period of time, these new waivers were rock and roll for a new generation. Here's Bruce Gary and the Knack from 1979.
My motor up, cut it.
In an era when it was common to spend a year and $1 million in the studio, the Knack's first album was completed in 11 days for $17,000. Capitol Records introduced the band with a level of fanfare not seen since the Beatles. In fact, Rolling Stone magazine dubbed them the new Fab Four. But critical backlash at what appeared to be overnight success has led to the band being marginalized in rock history. Today, your original Nuke the Knack button is worth big bucks on eBay. California native Bruce Gary comes to rock and roll heaven at the age of 55. In keeping with the beat, we turn now to a man who utilized complicated cross rhythms to help create what became known across the globe as the Bo Diddley beat. It's hard to imagine rock and roll without the primal sound of drummer Clifton James.
You've heard it, thing. Let me buy you wedding ring. Let me hear the choir sing. Oh, you've heard it, thing. You've heard it, thing. Let me walk you down the aisle. Colin, wear a lovely smile.
Clifton James was Bo Diddley's drummer of choice between 1954 and 1970. British rockers The Pretty Things took their name from that 1956 recording, much in the way their big rivals The Rolling Stones had copped their handle from a Muddy Waters tune. In the early 60s, these two bands battled it out to be crowned the anti-Beatles. History cites the Stones as winners of that engagement. Before his passing at the age of 69, Chicago native Clifton James backed an impressive array of artists in addition to Bo, including Muddy Waters and the Howlin' Wolf. You are listening to Rock and Roll Heaven as we induct the class of 2006. Rock's unsung shakers and movers who passed away between Thanksgiving 2005 and Thanksgiving 2006. I'm your host, Dennis Blackledge. We pause now to pay our respects to members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame who left us during the past induction year. We start with R&B innovators Prentice Barnes and Peter Graves, whose Moon Glows scored nearly two dozen hits on the R&B charts during the 1950s. Soul shouter Wilson Pickett, his star may not have been the brightest in the soul galaxy, but he had a wicked influence on a wide range of artists who followed. The man who shot Liberty Valance, singer and songwriter Gene Pitney. Vince Welnick, who tickled the skeleton keys for the Grateful Dead from 1991 to 1995. And finally, Syd Barrett, the founder and original guiding light of Pink Floyd, whose life and career spiraled out of control after launching the band on its incredible odyssey. As Pink Floyd later sang in tribute to Mr. Barrett, "Shine on, you crazy diamond." Rock and Roll Heaven returns now to a time and a land that time is at risk of forgetting. During this, our Primordial Ooze segment, we honor those who participated in creating rock and roll by building its foundation. Henry James Townsend was a blues singer, guitarist, and piano player whose career spanned seven decades and whose many musical partners included Sonny Boy Williamson and Big Joe Williams. Born in Shelby, Mississippi, he spent his formative years in Cairo, Illinois, before becoming the patriarch of the St. Louis Blues. The Mule, as he was known, made his recording debut in 1929, ran with the legendary Robert Johnson, and is credited with teaching the Devil's son-in-law, Petey Wheatstraw, how to play the blues.
Still don't mean a doggone thing. Lord, it looked like the crime scene.
In later years, Henry became a living resource for those interested in the pre-World War II blues era, and in 1985 was honored with a National Heritage Award, our nation's highest honor for folk and traditional artists. Henry Townsend passed away just shy of his 97th birthday while in Grafton, Wisconsin, to be honored as the last living musician to have recorded for the legendary Paramount label.
California, a university and beach town, one of America's most liberal cities, now has the toughest panhandling ordinance in California. Sitting on downtown sidewalks, using profane language, panhandling while drunk, or lying about how the money will be spent, all illegal.
Now people are going to use fear and intimidation to try to hassle money out of other people. We're going to say, no, that's not allowed.
A self-proclaimed socialist led the crackdown.
They have some sense of entitlement. I don't know where they get it from. That somehow the city owes them. Give us your parks. Give us some place to stay, like we owe them a place to survive.
At the same time, the city does fund a wide range of services for the homeless. And it's not just Santa Cruz. Cities all over the U.S. are finding themselves fed up. They've run out of patience. Liberal cities like San Francisco, where police break up soup kitchens operated by the homeless activist group Food Not Bombs for operating without a permit.
I was convicted of serving soup at the Civic Center Plaza in front of City Hall and sentenced to 2 months in jail.
Next week, Santa Monica will adopt new laws banning aggressive solicitation.
People are beginning to say, we've got to grab hold of something and claim it and say, you know, this is going to be the way we're going to save our cities. The sad part is this is the absolute wrong way to do it, that we need to support the people in the inner cities, help them get the jobs and housing and health care they need, or the problem's going to get much worse.
Reporter John Robinson went undercover as a panhandler for a newspaper story.
More than one person spit at my feet.
Americans have always been charitable, but there seems to be little of that feeling left for people who, instead of asking for help, demand it.
The homeless, a problem for only one reason. That president raises the question, who wants a plan? The homeless, a problem for only one reason. A president raises the question, who wants a plan? Who? Who owns the land?
against the law to feed homeless. It's against the law to sleep in the park. It's against the law for you to see me. I live outside. I'm against the law. I'm a criminal. Cop, I want to eat. Fuck you, mayor, I live here. Fuck you, law-abiding citizen, you pushed me here. Fuck you, voter, I will never disappear. All your systems will crash one day, and you will crawl to me.
Back when I was drinking, I'd crash my truck into the side of a new Rolls Royce. I didn't stab by a fella with a bowie knife for seeing this girl named Joyce. I got run over just crossing the street. I lost a finger in Ohio. My wife ran off with my best friend John. I took a bullet to Mexico. I've been chased by large crowds of angry people, not knowing exactly why. Got thrown in jail in three different states. It's enough to make a grown man cry. And that was just one day. That was just one day. That was just one day. Thank God I quit drinking. That was just one day. That was just one day. And that was just one day. That was just one day. Thank God I quit drinking. That was just one day. When I was drinking, I wrote bad checks to the man at the IRS. Then things got bad and I kept running from town to town, I guess. Got in 34 fights in 13 bars and I only won about two. Broke three ribs and an arm in Dallas, but that was nothing new. Then a Texas lawman named Billy McCoy, standing tall and mean, insisted I take a nice long ride in his black and white limousine. That was just one day. That was just one day. That was just one day. Thank God I quit drinking. That was just one day. Ago, I ain't touched a drop since then. You can check downtown, my record's clean, but I remember when. Back when I was drinking, I'd crash my truck into the side of a new Rolls Royce. I've been stabbed by a fella with a bowie knife for seeing this girl named Joyce. Got run over just crossing the street. I lost a finger in Ohio. My wife ran off with my best friend John. I took a bullet to Mexico. Been chased by large crowds of angry people, not knowing exactly why. Got thrown in jail in three different states. It's enough to make a grown man cry. That was just one day. That was just one day. That was just one day. Thank God I quit drinking. That was just one day. And that was just one day. That was just one day. That was just one day. Thank God I quit drinking. That was just one day.
All right. Is this registering? Yes, it is. Okay. Hello, folks. Hey, this is your pale imitation of the genuine article, Robert Norse. This is Thomas Levitt standing in somewhat late for Robert, who had a personal emergency and asked me to sub for him. And then I had a personal emergency and kind of spaced out where I was supposed to be at 6 o'clock. But anyway, this is Thomas Levitt, and this is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. And the programming we had arranged left the building, or never walked into the building, actually. So I'm going to wing it. What you just heard was a series of tracks from, in reverse order, Voice of the Homeless, which is an album of, let's see, original songs by homeless people, or formerly homeless people. And let's see, we heard in reverse order, and sorry, let me just dig this up. Thank God I Quit Drinking. Lyrics and music by Rick Nielsen. And let's see. There's the little biography of him. Sometimes there's a little biography of each of these people. Nope. I don't see it. Okay, so... And then before that, that was Thank God I Quit Drinking, lyrics and music by Rick Nielsen. And before that, we heard Shuffle the Deck. And lyrics and music by Joe Wassel. And song concept by Cio Vasquez. The lead vocal was Wanda Mae Ralph, age 35, from San Diego, California, formerly a beautician. She is now the director of her church choir and a single mother of four children. As of the recording, August 93, she was homeless for 3 years. And then actually the Thank God I Quit Drinking song was sung by Stephen Lowe Wolf, age 49, a Native American from New Bern, North Carolina, a professor of anthropology formerly at a Florida university. As of the recording, August 93, he'd been homeless for 13 months. So that was those two songs, and that was off Voice of the Homeless, MAG Records, copyright 1993. And then the previous set of songs were off of a house-produced Houseless USA Volume 1 from 2001. And you heard in reverse order, Liberal San Francisco, sung by Seth. Land, sung by 15 off the Lucky album, and then a soundbite from CNN on the anti-homeless panhandling ordinance passed in Santa Cruz, and the Let It Be, sung by Crazy Timmy on the Street. And that's what I came up with right off the top of my head when I walked into the studio half an hour late. Again, apologies for being late and for the dead air. But I can only do what I can only do, and sometimes I'm less than perfect, as you can. People who know me well know I'm well less than perfect in many areas. If you want to call in, you can dial in to 427-3772. Give me a report off the street over what's happening. Your opinions about anything related to housing, homelessness, civil liberties in Santa Cruz, etc., etc. Just give me a call. And but right now, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to go read some news articles that are somewhat relevant. This is an article from the Huff Santa Cruz mailing list, groups, yahoo.com/group/Huff Santa Cruz, if you want to subscribe. Get updates about various homeless civil liberties and civil rights efforts and activities. This is from the Daily News. I guess that's a Palo Alto newspaper. Homeless, any help? A sign made out of a cardboard box lies on the sidewalk next to a group of homeless vets and veterans in downtown Palo Alto on Tuesday. Members of the Palo Alto Police Force, city staff, elected officials, and the business community gathered Tuesday to discuss how to stop the city's homeless population from panhandling and loitering, both of which are completely constitutional activities protected by U.S. Supreme Court decisions. You can't force someone to move along simply for doing nothing other than standing or hanging around. And as long as someone operates within a reasonable scope of behavior when they're asking people for money, it's constitutionally protected free speech. Poor people have the right to ask the public for help. But, of course, you can't actually have poor people visible in a commercial business district because that just spoils the capitalist corporate consumer mood to be reminded of how close to, that position these people you are yourself as a consumer. You know, most people are only a paycheck or two away from being homeless themselves. And being reminded of that, you know, kind of makes them less inclined to go piss away all their money on random consumer fucking crap. Anyway, tough love, quote unquote, for the homeless. Yeah, city to increase in homelessness services, police presence. Yeah, and you know what the balance of that is? Palo Alto needs to shed its reputation as a haven for the homeless by enacting stricter laws and providing more human services, members of Palo Alto's business community and city staff said Tuesday. You notice how in these meetings there was no actual homeless people involved, obviously, nor even advocates for homeless people, self-appointed or otherwise. It's just city staff, police, and members of the business community. It's called tough love. Sherry Bijan, executive director of the city's business improvement district, said at a roundtable discussion on the city's homeless population. City manager Frank Benest announced he will recommend expanding Palo Alto's sit-lie ordinance to apply to the entire downtown area. The ordinance prohibits anyone on University Avenue between Cowper Avenue and High Streets from sitting on anything other than a city bench. We need to minimize panhandling in the downtown if we're going to be successful, Benest said. The city is also looking into hiring private security to patrol the city's downtown parking lots and garages in the early morning and entering into a contract with the downtown streets teams, which employs homeless people to maintain sidewalks and streets, to also clean downtown garages where many unhoused people sleep in cold weather. Yes. All right. I don't think I even have to comment on the nature of this. Eileen Richardson, executive director of the streets team, outlined a quote-unquote care not cash program scheduled to roll out in June. Asking people to give money to social programs rather than directly to panhandlers will discourage the homeless from loitering outside stores, she said. Yeah, right. Elected officials will kick off the campaign by collecting money on the street for services that provide food and shelter to the homeless, like InVision. We need to take the revenue stream from the panhandlers and put it into the many great services in Palo Alto. The city's persistent panhandlers, who take up the most police attention, will be the focus of a new, quote-unquote, restorative policing program starting in early summer that aims to combine law enforcement with social services, such as substance abuse rehabilitation and psychological treatment, said Captain Dennis Burns of the Palo Alto Police Department. We'll be trying to identify the root cause for this person and try to treat that, he said. Burns and Kathy Espinoza Howard, the city's director of human services, met with a local judge last week to discuss sending chronic offenders to a treatment facility instead of jail. Under the law, aggressive panhandlers receive a citation. More serious offenses involving drugs or alcohol can lead to jail time. Burns also said the police department will have a greater presence on downtown streets with 11 officers in training hit the streets. Several members of the city's business community asked for stricter enforcement of the current sit-lie ordinance and said that they plan to call police when dealing with aggressive panhandlers. We welcome seeing a greater police presence downtown, said Georgie Gleam, owner of Gleam Jewelers. But others voiced concern that with an expanded ordinance, the homeless might be left without options. If you can't sit in Palo Alto, lie in Palo Alto, or sleep on the bus, how can you exist, asked Faith Bell, manager of Bell's Book. We can't create a community where people have absolutely nowhere to be. Well, you know, that's where things clearly are headed in Palo Alto, or they would like things to head. You know, there's nothing wrong with offering people access to social services that they can voluntarily, participate in. There's nothing wrong with talking to people and trying to find out what their issues are and offering them help. But there's a lot wrong with simply criminalizing normal human behavior or even abnormal human behavior that's imposed on people by the fact of their being homeless. You know, it's not normal human behavior for most of us to simply stand around and ask people for money. But it's constitutionally protected, And it's something that people, if they have absolutely no other options for whatever reason, wind up doing. And it's something people have done for centuries and millennia. And, you know, no amount of social engineering is going to change that. You know, a more just, a more fair society is going to reduce the prevalence of that, going to reduce the number of people that are forced into doing that. But it's not likely to completely and totally eliminate it. Although I guess that's even possible, too. But certainly this typical tactic of creating a police state that selectively enforces laws against homeless people is not appropriate. And, you know, the values and priorities of the people doing this are pretty clear just by their own statements. And, of course, of this reporter. I mean, you know, the reporter doesn't go and ask a single goddamn homeless person what they think about this. It doesn't ask a single advocate for homeless people. It doesn't ask a single social service provider other than the one that's getting paid or is going to get paid as a result of these policies. You know, that's just so totally typical. And there's no questioning in this article of why none of these people are involved, none of these people are engaged. There's no real story except for that photograph of why these people are there and why they have to ask for money in order to just get what they need to survive. You know, that's your typical corporate media. Now here's an alternative non-corporate media. Fresno Mayor Alan Eltry undermines the homeless. A great story by journalist and advocate Mike Rhodes that shows what can be done when activists from different classes and issues mobilize and use the media embarrassment and the power of the courts to press for the obvious. Check out the Fresno story and the crescendoing wave of pressure on City Hall to set up some basic facilities for homeless people. Robert Norris. That's Robert's statement. And here's IndieBay.org. A majority of Fresno City Council members want to install portable toilets and a trash bin near a downtown homeless encampment. Mayor Alan Autry is opposed, and City Manager Andrew Souza says they will not act on the council's request. So, you know, there's your city staff saying, fuck you, to an elected city council. Democratic process, fuck you. We know best. We're not going to listen to you. A proposal by the Fresno City, this is from the Mike Rhodes article. A proposal by the Fresno City Council to place portable toilets and trash bins near a homeless encampment was thwarted by City Manager Andrew Souza, who said he would not follow the council's recommendation. Souza said he had spoken with Mayor Alan Autry about the issue and that Autry is adamant in his opposition to placing trash bins and portable toilets near homeless encampments. God forbid that people have a place to put their trash and to go to the bathroom. You know, it's much better to have people just, you know, leave their trash on the ground because they have no place to put it, and to be forced to take a piss or a dump in a corner because there's no place within reasonable walking distance that provides them the ability to do this. Because they don't live in a house and they don't have, you know, a toilet of their own, a private toilet for them to do anything. The City Council of Fresno voted 5-2 in support of the non-binding resolution. Of course, this was a non-binding resolution. God forbid a politician ever display any spine. To direct the city manager to place the facilities at one downtown homeless encampment. City Council members Jerry Duncan and Cynthia Sterling sponsored the proposal, saying that the homeless people, if they are denied these basic services, will be facing serious health and safety problems. Well, no, duh. Not to mention everyone else. Duncan brought up the issue of placing portable toilets and trash bins near downtown in February of this year. At the time, Duncan talked about the hardship of residents and small business owners who live in the area and have to deal with the problem of hundreds of homeless people who have nowhere to go to the bathroom or any place to put their trash. And there's a link to another article. You can go to www.indiebay.org/newsitems/2007/04/10 1-839-4028 PHP, or I would just go to like Indy Bay, Santa Cruz Indy Bay, or actually, yeah, just go to indybay.org and search for Mayor Alan Autry, Autry, homeless. And I'm sure it'll come up in the search engine if you want to read this yourself and if you want to see the other articles that it links to. A couple weeks ago, the city of Fresno removed the trash from a homeless encampment known as The Hill, where garbage had accumulated for months. Big Sue, a resident of The Hill, said that when the city cleaned up the garbage, see photo above, rats the size of cats could be seen running from the pile. Yeah, there was a big pile, and people were obviously trying to be neat about just putting all their stuff in one place, but they didn't have a place to put it. All of this is taking place in the midst of a lawsuit filed by homeless people who had their property taken and immediately destroyed by city work crews. A federal judge in that case has issued a temporary restraining order preventing the city from conducting any raids on homeless encampments that result in the destruction of homeless people's property. My God, what a concept. Homeless people's property might deserve some respect, just like house people's property deserves respect, or you know, business owners' property. God forbid that we disrespect that. Last week, homeless people were evicted near Roeding Park without bulldozers destroying their property. The city of Fresno is in the process of developing a new policy on homelessness, and what happened today could be viewed in that context. Mayor Autry says he does not want to legitimize the homeless encampments by providing services. He and his staff in the city's manager's office say they are looking for long-term solutions, and they do not want to abandon the homeless by simply putting up portable toilets and a few trash bins. That's what they always say. That's what these fucking politicians and bureaucrats always say. That's what our own city council says. Well, we don't want to, like, abandon the homeless and, like, by providing them with the most basic essential ability to actually survive, because we're focused on providing long-term solutions. We're focused on We don't want them living on the street. We want them housed. You know, God forbid. You know, and that's great, except for the fact that, you know, under the best case scenario, what you're proposing is going to house about like 5 to 10% of the homeless population. And the other 90% is going to continue to have to survive on the streets because you're not going to provide enough resources to actually house all of them, God forbid. And so by refusing to deal with the fact of where people are right now and what they have to do to survive and refusing to provide them with like a legalized campground, a safe and legal place to sleep or any of the most minimal like public toilets, trash bins, whatever you say is like, you know, a short-term fix that we can't really do because that would just like, you know, be disrespectful. And what we really need to do is we really need to provide them with housing and services and blah and blah and blah, and that's all great, except for the fact that, you know, you haven't done it. You're not likely to do it anytime soon. You say the resources aren't there to do it. So why not deal with the reality of where people are right now? Why not give them the opportunity to engage in those basic human fucking behaviors like taking a shit, taking a piss, sleeping under a blanket in a safe and legal fashion, or in a safer and more legal fashion than it is now? It's bullshit. Every time you hear a politician saying, I don't want to provide emergency shelter because we need to house people. I don't want to provide public toilets because we need to house people. And we can't, you know, just let ourselves off with like a short-term quick fix. Basically what they're lying. It's hypocrisy. And they know it. Anyway. Because nothing. And sorry. You know, I'm breaking up this article, but this pisses me off so much. You know what? Here's a quote. Mayor Autry says he does not want to legitimize the homeless encampments by providing services. He and his staff in the city's manager's office say they are looking for long-term solutions and they do not want to abandon the homeless by simply putting up portable toilets and a few trash bins. Okay. One, how do you abandon the homeless by providing them with trash bins and portable toilets? How is that abandoning the homeless? Only if that's all you ever intended to do and all you were ever going to do could that even remotely be defined as abandoning the homeless. And so that's the first thing. And the second thing is providing people right now, this moment, who don't have a place to take a shit, don't have a place to throw away their trash, with trash bins and portable toilets. Nothing involved in that. Nothing involved in that. Nothing involved in doing that prevents you from executing on those long-term fucking solutions. Only in the logic of politicians and bureaucrats is fixing something short-term somehow preventing you from doing something long-term. When somebody fucking breaks your window, putting up a board over the fucking broken piece of the window does not prevent you from going to the store in the next couple of days, buying the glass, and then replacing the broken glass. But according to this logic, according to the city manager of Fresno and his staff, and according to the city of Santa Cruz's elected officials and many bureaucrats, putting a board over the window is somehow preventing them from executing on actually going to get the glass and replacing the fucking window. Bullshit. The Fresno Police Department issued a memo to city council members yesterday outlining their opposition to the placement of trash bins and portable toilets near the homeless encampment. The FPD memo was mentioned by several council members during today's discussion. The FPD's opposition reinforced the city manager and mayor's position. The memo detailed numerous potential problems with allowing the homeless to have portable toilets and trash bins. For example, the memo suggested that homeless people would clog the portable toilets with hypodermic needles, clothing, and other inorganic matter. Well, you know what? All that shit is being fucking thrown somewhere right now. And I'm sure you can design the things to fucking prevent that or minimize it. Or you can simply service the goddamn fucking toilets often enough that it doesn't become an issue. And, you know, I think realistically that most homeless people, when given the opportunity to take a shit, are not going to somehow deliberately fuck that up. And they're going to do their best to encourage their peers and the people around them to not fuck it up either. The memo decided a December 2003, January 24 instance where two portable toilets were purchased by the Pervarela House, which is a homeless shelter in downtown Fresno, for public use. One was larger to ensure ADA compliance. The larger unit in particular was used for sex acts and illegal activities. Illegal drug use was especially prominent. Well, you know what? Then you fucking stick a fucking staff member. Pay someone fucking $15 an hour to sit next to the fucking toilets and make sure people aren't fucking in them, aren't fucking taking Johns in them, and aren't shooting up in them. You know, it's just a matter of whether or not you're actually committed to solving the problem. City Councilmember Duncan asked Captain David Belluomini of the FPD, if the portable toilets are not installed near the homeless encampments, what are people supposed to do when nature calls? Belluomini answered, we don't perceive it as a law enforcement issue as much as a health and safety issue. I don't have an answer to your question, quite frankly. Duncan then asked about the illegal activities and asked if that was something that the FPD thought might happen because of the trash bins and portable toilets. Belluomini was unable to cite any evidence showing a correlation between increased drug use, prostitution, etc., and providing homeless people with these facilities. Belluomini did suggest, however, that having these facilities might bring more homeless people to the area. Duncan said, I have yet to talk with one person who has indicated to me that they are going to abandon their home and job and go live on the street because we have a toilet for them to use. Council member Henry Perea, where are these council members? Why aren't they here in Santa Cruz? God damn, Fresno is more liberal than Santa Cruz, the city council? I mean, what's up with that?
That's really fucking weird. Can you imagine the city council member fucking quizzing the fucking police department that way at this point in Santa Cruz? I don't hear Ryan Coonerty doing that. I don't hear Mike Rotkin, the famed socialist feminist, doing that. I don't hear Emily Riley doing that. I don't hear Ed Porter doing that. Council member Henry Perea wanted to change the proposal so it would force the city's city manager's office to place the facilities near the homeless encampment. After some discussion, it was agreed to vote on the non-binding resolution today, and the city manager does not act on the request. The item will be brought back next Tuesday, April 17th. So it's a binding resolution. The vote was 5-2 with Larry Westerlund and Mike Daggers opposed to the proposal. With 5 votes, this item could withstand a mayoral veto. For a list of articles and documents about the struggle for civil liberties for homeless people in Fresno, see http://fresnoalliance.com/home/homelessness.htm. fresnoalliance.com/home. And then this article has various pictures. Various politicians and citizens and bureaucrats. All right. So have we had enough bladder for me yet? It's 7:19 p.m. So, anyway. Unlike Robert, I like to break up my shit with some occasional music. Because, I mean, you know, God knows. Who the fuck wants to listen to me rant and rave about the fucking stupidity of our local elected officials and bureaucrats and corrupt, criminal, hypocritical fucking behavior for 2 hours? I don't know if anybody wants to listen to Robert do that for 2 hours either. All right, so this track is entitled Sedition. Let's see if it's worth listening to.
Which law is the one that will take me, and which one?
Martial law.
Evil doers. Either you are with us,
evil doers,
or you are with the terrorists.
Barbaric killers. Assassins and trained killers are plotting to
protect us.
You know, so now they want us to feel safe. So how they do that? By scaring us to death.
And they keep trying to scare us.
Evil doers.
Welcome back to Terrorism Hits America. What now?
Evil.
Dick Cheney, man, he's on a damn scare tour. You can't turn the TV on, that man's scaring the hell out of you. So Sunday morning, I'm watching my favorite show, watching Face the Nation. There's Dick Cheney on it. That's like watching Creature Feature, man. Like, oh, yes, you know, another domestic attack, it will happen. It's going to happen anytime. It could happen now. Scaring us to death.
Evil. Evil.
And they keep trying to scare us. You know, everybody's trying to scare us. Tell us to be on the lookout for Al-Qaeda.
Scaring us to death.
Did Al-Qaeda blow up the building in Oklahoma? No. Did Al-Qaeda put anthrax in your mail? No. Did Al-Qaeda drag James Byrd down the street till his eyeballs popped out of his head? No.
Evil. Evil doers.
Hey, isn't it weird how every time there's bad news for the Bush administration, the terror alert goes up? You know, there's over 11 examples of it. Let me tell you something. It's called coincidence, all right? It's a coincidence that the terror alert happened to go up after that French report saying that Bush knew about 9/11. And it happened to go up 2 days after they said there was absolutely no link between Osama and Saddam Hussein. It happened to go up within 36 hours after the mad cow disease and the government might be implicit in it. And it happened to go up literally the day after the report that Halliburton overcharged for $65 million. And it happened to go up when Bush's ratings plummet. It's called coincidence, hippie freak.
Evil.
Finally, after nearly a month on high alert, our national terror alert status today was downgraded to yellow or elevated.
Terrorize this.
Evil.
You are engaged in an authorized procedure. Remain where you are.
Take this banner! Hang it up! Start down! This country's in distress. From the school to the factories on the south edge of town. This street's a fucking mess. This dream is fucked. Here we go. Our sisters and mothers right to shoot. Powers determined to make the news. Poison others down. The biggest power corrupts. And we pull it our will to sleep. In the radiation of writing pictures. We let the sharing move our sisters. Break out of on the hill. The road is red if you look close enough. Down in the valley of emergence. And we're here to track to run. Every disaster of the papers went to fortify their minds. Our creativity always wins. But now the day we die. 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 I say that young revolutionary change in blood. Living in a condition where the third world grows. Weary of supporting all the costume changes. All right. And there's more. New world disorder. Hammers to the bricks and water. Consciousness and crisis is up to you. So what are you gonna do?
All right, and that was three tracks.
I'm going to play some more, and then I'm going to rant and rave some more, since more or less that's all I can do, because I don't have any news, because I'm fucking like stuck trying to survive every day as much as possible. So that kind of constrains my ability to stir up stuff. Anyway, so let's see. That was Prisoner Echoes from Strike Anywhere, Dead FM. And before that was Fear USA off of a anti-Bush album. And I'll tell you more about that when I actually pull the CD out. And the first track was Sedition, like I said. So now we go back to, what is this, Fear of a New Era or something like that, from an album I'll tell you about after I played the song. All right, bye.
Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
Continuing ties to terrorist organizations.
Secretly and without fingerprints, he could provide one of his hidden weapons to terrorists.
The danger to our country is great.
Or help them develop their own.
The danger to our country is growing. The Iraqi regime possesses biological and chemical weapons. The Iraqi regime could launch a biological or chemical attack in as little as 45 minutes.
If someone is waiting for a so-called smoking gun, it's certain that we will have waited too long.
We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud.
We cannot wait for the final proof. The smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
The danger to our country is growing.
We found the weapons of mass destruction. We know where they are. We found biological laboratories.
Everybody knows that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
I have every reason to believe that the intelligence that we were operating off was correct.
No question, we have said that Saddam Hussein possesses biological and chemical weapons.
The smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north somewhere.
All this will be made clear in the course of the operation for whatever duration it takes.
And are you confident that you'll also find weapons of mass destruction?
I believe we will find evidence that the programs of chemical and biological weapons, yes.
How about the actual weapons?
Well, I just don't know. Let's wait and see what the team...
Inspections continue with our new exploitation teams that have been brought in. And that we will in fact find weapons or evidence of weapons programs that are conclusive.
It is somewhat puzzling, I think, that you can have 100% certainty about the weapons of mass destruction's existence and zero certainty about where they are.
Do you agree? And does it matter whether or not you find
those
weapons?
We might ask the Prime Minister that we won't be proven wrong.
This is a process that takes some time, and it will ebb and flow.
One thing we know is that he had a weapons program.
I don't know anybody that I can think of who has contended that the Iraqis had nuclear weapons.
And we believe he has, in fact, reconstituted nuclear weapons.
Iraqis continue to visit bin Laden in his new home in Afghanistan.
There are Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Saddam Hussein cavorts with terrorists.
But on the specific issue of weapons of mass destruction, it's going to take time, and we're going to have to be patient.
Over time, the truth will come out.
No, it's going to take time to find anything because they've had...
People will find that we presented a solid case, a case that is there and was there and will remain there.
So it's going to take a period of time to find the people. I don't think we'll discover anything myself.
I believe that we will find... the truth, and the truth is, he was developing a program for weapons of mass destruction.
I think what will happen is we'll discover people who will tell us where to go find it.
You're not going
to
find it simply in a house-to-house search. You're going to find it when people start to talk to you.
It is not like a treasure hunt where you just run around looking everywhere hoping you find something. I just don't think that's going to happen. The inspectors didn't find anything, and I doubt that we will.
Are people going to find out the truth? And the truth will say that it's intelligence is good intelligence, no doubt in my mind.
What we will do is find the people who will tell us. There are a lot of people who lie and get away with it, and that's just a fact.
Is U.S. credibility on the line over weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
I'm not exactly sure what that means.
All right, so that is actually a good cue for my theme song, my favorite song. Let's see. You heard off of this album, W, More Greatest Hits. Track 4, Fear USA. And track 6, Threats of a New Era. This is from Spin the World, which I guess is the album. And this track is off of Nine Inch Nails, and it is Terrible Lie, because we're living in a time of terrible, terrible lies. Lies told to us by people who should know better. Lies told us by people who we trust or trusted. Lies told to us by malicious, conniving individuals who know damn well from the very beginning that what they're saying is a lie. Not just misleading, not just a half-truth, not just a disagreement, an opinion, but a flat, out-and-out lie. Local, state, federal, international lies.
Thank you.
Okay, folks. All right, I'm going to read a PSA and an article, and I'm maybe going to get a call in the next few minutes. All right, so the PSA is: the Green Party of Santa Cruz invites you to a program on the current status of the death penalty in California, featuring Lance G. Lindsay, executive director of Death Penalty Focus and a death penalty expert. Monday, April 16th, 7 to 8:30 p.m., Luden Nelson Community Center, 301 Center Street at Laurel Street, Santa Cruz. For more information, dial 476-5019. And again, that's the Green Party of Santa Cruz program on the current status of the death penalty in California, featuring Lawrence G. Lindsay, executive director of the Death Penalty Focus Organization. Monday, April 16th, 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Luden Nelson, 301 Center Street at Laurel Street, Santa Cruz. 476-5019 for more information. This is an article off the Huff Santa Cruz group. Florida food fight, success in Fort Myers, new police bus in Orla. http://stop-orlando.org. You can probably just type stop-orlando.org into your browser, and you will get Orlando Food Not Bombs. Arrested for sharing food with a homeless. Orlando police escort Eric Montanez from Lake Eola Park after his arrest. Photo by Rima Jenkins. A member of Orlando Food Not Bombs was arrested this evening while he was feeding homeless people downtown. Police said Eric Montanez violated a controversial city ordinance that restricts food sharings in Lake Eola Park and other downtown parks. The ordinance prohibits participating in a large group feeding that attracts 25 or more people, including distributors and servers. Undercover officers said Montanez served food to 30 people, said a police spokesman. So they have undercover cops sitting there counting how many people get fed. What a great expenditure of public resources. Violation of the city ordinance is a misdemeanor. Food Not Bombs and Montanez are plaintiffs in a federal lawsuit against the city challenging that ordinance is unconstitutional. Orlando man becomes first arrested in city for sharing food with the homeless. Eric Montanez, a member of Orlando Food Not Bombs, FNB, became on Wednesday, April 4th, the first person and the first member of Orlando Food Not Bombs arrested for violating the City of Orlando's large group feedings ordinance. This measure essentially bans sharing food with homeless people in 42 parks in downtown Orlando within a 2-mile radius of Orlando City Hall. It's driven by bigotry against the homeless and the desire for profits and gentrification by downtown developers and business interests. Doesn't that sound familiar? Can't have homeless people anywhere near where people are actually in business making money, because that reminds the rest of us that, hey, you know, but for the grace of God go I. And maybe I really don't need this expensive piece of crap. Maybe I should save the money. Maybe I should use it for some more socially beneficial purpose than gratifying my most recent consumerist impulse. How un-American that would be. The ordinance's main proponents are Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer and City Commissioner Patty Sheehan, whose district includes Lake Eola Park, where Orlando FNB shares. Eric's arrest contradicts the statement that Orlando police made to the Orlando Sentinel March 22nd. Police say an ordinance adopted last summer to end feeding the homeless in city parks is not being enforced until a court rules on its legality. Emphasis added by us being Food Not Bombs. Of course, Orlando FNB and other groups concerned with helping the homeless have learned through hard experience that they can't trust Orlando's public officials, employees, lawyers, or cops. They say one thing to lawyers for FNB, homeless advocates such as Stop the Orlando Ordinance Partnership, and the media, and then their actions contradict their promises. The March 22nd article was about a news conference that the Central Florida ACLU, ACORN, Orlando Food Not Bombs, and others held outside Orlando Police Headquarters to denounce Orlando police harassment at the African-American community and Orlando police harassment of FNB. The harassment experienced by FNB has included parking tickets received by three FNB members on March 14th while food was being unloaded from their cars, coupled with videotaping of the drivers in their vehicles and license plates. The videotaping reoccurred on March 28th. Lawyers from the ACLU posted a $250 bond for Eric, and he was able to sleep in his own bed the night he was arrested. Below are links to articles from the Orlando Sentinel and a report from a local TV station about Eric's arrest. And that's, you know, if you're reading it on the Stop-Orlando website. Lawyers for the ACLU are going to pursue legal remedies to the harassment of and surveillance of Orlando Food Not Bombs and enforcement of the ordinance, pending the federal court trial in June of 2008 on the lawsuit. That lawsuit was filed in October of 2006 by Orlando FNB and the First Vagabonds Church of God. Orlando FNB started sharing at Lake Eola Park in May of 2005. However, between August 2006 and January 2007, the group shared on the street corner, Osceola and Pine, about a block from the park. The group decided to go back into the park because of police harassment at the street corner location, and based upon our legal team's assessment of the provisions of the ordinance. Since being back in the park, Orlando FNB has been sharing with multiple groups, including Orlando Code Pink Women for Peace and Orlando Chapter of the Young Communist League, allies who are group members of STOP, Stop the Ordinance Partnership. If the number of groups sharing food is divided by the number of people with whom food is being shared, then the city is wrong in its apparent belief that the number of people being shared with by Eric or anyone else has risen to the level necessary to trigger the permitting requirements of the large group feedings ordinance. Orlando had a record-setting 49 murders last year, and more than a dozen so far this year, but the Orlando Police Department could spare the police resources necessary to surveil Orlando Food Not Bombs and its allies, to harass and to try to intimidate them, and to arrest Eric for the crime of sharing food with hungry and homeless people. You know, and that's also quite common to ellipsis here a bit again and go off on a tangent. You know, what are the priorities of our elected officials, our bureaucrats, and our police departments? Are they real crime? Or are they protecting the status quo and facilitating the ability of the cash to flow? What does it mean when you walk downtown and you see six police officers surrounding one homeless or apparently homeless individual for 20 minutes? What does it mean when you're standing in front of your house, as I was at one point, and you see six police officers, you know, three police cars surrounding one bicyclist for 30 minutes to arrest him? What does it mean when, you know, so many resources are put into patrolling downtown to make it quote-unquote safer? And yet, all the other rest of the city has to make do with whatever's left over. Now, what does that really say? I mean, to me, it says it's very clear that, you know, the role of the police is as much to reinforce the status quo and to facilitate, you know, the ability of commerce to proceed undisturbed by uncomfortable images of poor and homeless people, and to, you know, send a message to all the people there that, you know, if you're there, you better be spending money, because it's not public space for public use, you know? It's for the purpose of commerce. Eric's arrest involved the use of at least a dozen OPD officers, two undercover cops videotaping, eight to arrest Eric, and two supervisors. At a time when it has been proposed that the OPD should hire 75 more officers to help it cope with a spiraling violent crime rate. That says volumes about the city of Orlando's callous attitudes towards the homeless and its bias in favor of the affluent and well-connected and its misplaced priorities. Orlando FNB and its allies will not be intimidated and will be back in the park every week to share food with the people who need it. All right. Anyway, so, you know, that's the article. That's what's happening in Orlando. And, you know, I don't have to say anything about the parallels between that and what happens in Santa Cruz. And, you know, the priorities of our local elected officials, bureaucrats, and police department. And, you know, just the morality or immorality of the current situation where there's not a safe and legal place for a person without a home to sleep in the city of Santa Cruz. If you're not paying rent to a landlord, or you're not a property owner, unless someone is gifting you with free sleeping space, there is no legal place for you to be. And the city has no intentions of ever doing anything different. Even though the resources required to make such a space available would be far, 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 far less than the resources required and spent to harass homeless people, destroy their possessions, and destroy their civil liberties and give them records and tickets and financial liabilities and, you know, toss a few more fucking stones, you know, on the mass that they're already carrying. A few more straws on the broken camel's back. You know, anyway, so we're going to go out right now because I have to do something before I leave, and there's only 8 minutes left. So I am going to play some Bob Marley, because after all that fucking ranting and raving and things that just pissed me the fuck off, I need something else. And I don't even know what this is. It just says Bob Marley, France, 1973. God knows. If it pisses anyone off, I'm sorry. Let's go.
Thank you. And we're going to leave Bob Marley out there somewhere. Don't even know where the case for this CD is, but anyway. I'm Uncle Dennis. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1. We're also at www.freakradio.org and various other spots around the dial on the internet. So, anyway, for the next 3 hours, you're going to be listening to a show called From the Cream to the Dregs. And tonight we're going to start off with some Allman Brothers. Stay tuned. We're going to open the Brew of the Week here in just a few minutes. And then, of course, at 9 o'clock, the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. And at 10 o'clock, our Spotlight Group of the Week. So lots coming up. Stay tuned. Free Radio is the place to be. The Allman Brothers in your ears.
Living alone.
it sometimes, then you don't. But leave your mind alone and just get high.
You're bound to see my love is there.